I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Everyone who comes to our studio is astonished by the amazing view we have of New York City. We occupy one tiny old circular floor 30 stories up with windows looking out in almost every direction, 360 degrees. My standard line to guests is how impossibly glamorous that panorama is, like something from a movie with a soundtrack by George Gershwin. It really is the epitome of that thrilling Manhattan evoked by E.B. White's famous line, "No one should come to New York unless he's willing to be lucky." Part of our panorama was the World Trade Center, three blocks west and a few blocks south, maybe 1,000 yards away. So today, our astonishing and iconic view from the 30th floor is astonishing and iconic in an entirely new way. And White's wonderful line about New Yorkers' special willingness to be lucky also has a new second meaning today. Last weekend, I was rereading White's essay, which is called "This is New York," and I came across a passage I'd somehow never really noticed before. It literally took my breath away when I came across it. White was writing 53 years ago in 1948. "The subtlest change in New York," he wrote, "is something people don't speak about much, but that is in everyone's mind. The city, for the first time in its long history, is destructible. A single flight of planes, no bigger than a wedge of geese, can quickly end this island fantasy, burn the towers, crumble the bridges. The intimation of mortality is part of New York now, in the sound of jets overhead, in the black headlines of the latest edition. In New York, the fact is somewhat more concentrated because of the concentration of the city itself. And because of all targets, New York has a certain clear priority. In the mind of whatever perverted dreamer might loose the lightning, New York must hold a steady, irresistible charm." Again, E.B. White wrote that in 1948. The United Nations headquarters had just been finished uptown, and the UN was very much on White's mind at the time. He wrote, "A block or two west of the UN, there's an old willow tree that presides over an interior garden. It is a battered tree, long-suffering and much climbed, held together by strands of wire, but beloved of those who know it. In a way, it symbolizes the city, life under difficulties, growth against odds, surprise in the midst of concrete, and the steady reaching for the sun." E.B. White wrote in 1948, "Whenever I look at it nowadays," speaking of the tree, "and feel the cold shadow of the plains, I think, this must be saved, this particular thing, this very tree. If it were to go, all would go. This city, this mischievous and marvelous monument, which not to look upon would be like death." White was a writer, an artist trying to convey the splendor and the terrifying precariousness of this city and of civilization at the cusp of World War II and the Cold War. Art of all kinds is a way that serious people try to give some shape and sense and occasionally beauty to the chaos of real life. Which is to say, for me, as for many of you, I'm sure, art can sometimes serve as a kind of religion. A religion that does not provide one easy, overarching answer to life's mysteries and ugliness and moral quandaries. Joining me today are two New York artists to talk about what music and poetry and other art have told us before about war and suffering and righteousness and anger, and what they might tell us this time. Marie Ponceau is a poet, teacher, and a native New Yorker. Her recent collection, The Birdcatcher, won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Ponceau's first book of poems, True Minds, was published in 1957. John Corigliano is also a native New Yorker and a composer who writes for orchestra and chamber groups and opera, as well as films, including The Red Violin and Altered States. Corigliano won the Pulitzer Prize this year for his second symphony, and his first symphony was a memorial to the lives lost to AIDS. John and Marie, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks, Kurt.
Thank you.
Now that this most shocking and disturbing event has happened, and happened in America's great center of art and the arts, does the role of art have some transformed character? Can it do what it's always done, or must it do something new?
I think it's a very sharp moment for people in the arts, those who love the arts, those who make them. I think it asks particularly of people who make art a very poignant question. If you think that art is not worth doing in a time like this, it probably isn't worth doing at any time. If you think that art is indeed part of what I call, because I don't know what else to name it, what I call the world's work, if art is part of the world's work, then to be loyal to it and to look to it for strength, for its strength now, seems right, seems appropriate.
Well, my feelings are similar. I also picked up on something you said earlier that I think must be stressed about art, and that is that art isn't like religion. That is, the artist is not a god. And we have to be aware of that because in certainly the late 19th century, the idea of the artist as God and prophet became very popular. And as you see what happens when people become gods, great destruction can follow. You can write to God, but not as God. And I think every artist has got to understand that he or she is a human being reaching out to other people and often to God, but keep that quality of humanness and never the quality of I am the way, which I think can lead to great destructive things in this world and destructive things in art.
Oh, boy, do I ever agree. The artist is the person, primarily. The making of art is a human possibility, a characterizing human possibility. I don't think we have to see ourselves either as bohemian, as drunk in some midnight madness, or as divine, as unapproachable, as supremely important and significant. It's work. It's something that you perfect through practice. It's just like shooting hoops, only inside your head, you know.
John, you have composed many scores for films. And last Tuesday, as people were watching those extraordinary, ghastly, mesmerizing images of the trade towers being attacked, the reaction almost universally was, my God, that's like a movie. It's like a special effect.
Well, there's absolutely no question that everything seen on television is a show. They even talked about the theatricality of the moment, that these monsters created a great theatrical event. People are reviewed. Monsters are reviewed. Presidents. It's all a beauty contest. It's all about how you look. There is no reality on television. And in fact, a rather curious thing happened to me on that day. William M. Hoffman, who is a poet and who is the librettist of the opera The Ghost of Versailles that I wrote, he wrote the play As Is that was on Broadway, the first AIDS play. He lives on Prince Street, which is 1 mile from the World Trade Center, and his windows face the World Trade Center. And at 8 o'clock in the morning, I live on Upper West Side, 77th Street. I got a call from him saying, hurry up, turn your television on. A plane just went into the World Trade Center. And during the day, he watched it, and I watched it, excepting he was watching it through his windows as a live event. And I was watching it on television as a televised event. And the difference between us was that while I was shocked and horrified and upset and angered, he was completely destroyed because he saw it really happen. And we're not used to seeing it really happen. He said to me, have you been down there yet? I said, no. He said, you really should go because everything is an illusion on television and film. And only when you really see it. And he said he had to come up with me and stay at my place for a couple of days psychologically to get away from it, because it was so unbelievably emotionally wrenching to someone who saw it with his own eyes. I mean, we don't see television not with our own eyes. It's produced. It's cultivated. It's, you know, various shots. They desensitized us by playing the second plane going into that building 8,000 times, so that now it's become a video event. And I must say, it's lost its emotional punch. Rather than making it stronger, they've made it weaker by making it a show. And I'm not saying that they had any choice in the matter. And, you know, this is obviously something that people must see. But when you see it over and over again, it isn't real.
It becomes like an Andy Warhol multiple.
It really does. I found with each re-seeing of that same plane, knowing what it was going to do and watching the ball of flame come out, that I stopped watching it with my heart in my mouth and started watching it as video.
Marie, I'm sorry.
I have a television set only fairly recently. One of my children finally bought me one about 8-9 years ago. So my view of it is a little different. And one thing I have noticed about people's perception of television is that it has still a commanding power when it shows the actual, not a rerun, not a produced version, but the raw thing. There's a reason that Monday Night Football is so popular. It's real. It's happening.
Marie, you were, unlike me, and I believe unlike John as well, you were sentient and virtually an adult when World War II began, which I guess is...
I was 18.
Mm-hmm. And does the fact that you lived through that, that we as a world lived through that, and the triumph of the good was achieved, does that give you any sense of special comfort, reassurance, hope at this moment?
Gives me enormous reassurance. I know that the human animal has a great war going on inside between all kinds of forces and impulses, but endurance is the subset for both of them. And what is good will endure, along with many of the treacheries of what is dreadful. What I did take from World War II, and I will try not to rave on about this, but it was the great moment of this last week for me, which was pretty desolate. The face in the Times on Sunday of the young fireman going up the stairs, a face taken by someone who was coming down, is absolutely unforgettable and speaks to the subset of strength that we all have in us somewhere. But before that, I had heard on C-SPAN a young woman from Georgetown saying, I don't know, but I think what we need right now is a new Marshall Plan. We need, and that's a great emblem of World War II and its consequences, we need to think of the countries of the Middle East in a way that makes us want to learn to speak their language and find out what they most desperately need. Not the people in charge, but the people. And do something to give it to them.
And perhaps you're right, but in the case of the Marshall Plan, certainly we had defeated them first. I mean, I agree with your impulse and the both its generosity and its practicality.
It's practical.
In this case, it may be that a war needs to be waged even as the Marshall Plan equivalent is being executed, which is a strange new set of circumstances.
If not a war, something. I don't know how we can envisage it. I have no capacities of that kind at all. I do believe that history teaches us that violence begets violence, begets violence, begets violence. And as a history of mankind, that is not our greatest strength. But I'm not naive. I'm not a simple pacifist. I think that it will take us another million years to evolve past.
You've brought with you today, and I perhaps know, W.H. Auden's poem written in 1939 at the very beginning of World War II called September 1st.
Yes. September 1st, 1939, by W.H. Auden. I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street, uncertain and afraid as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade. Waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth, obsessing our private lives. The unmentionable odor of death offends the September night. I and the public know what all schoolchildren learn. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. Into this neutral air where blind skyscrapers use their full height to proclaim the strength of collective man, each language pours its vain, competitive excuse. But who can live for long in a euphoric dream? Out of the mirror they stare, imperialism's face and the international wrong. Faces along the bar cling to their average day. The lights must never go out. The music must always play. All the conventions conspire to make this fort assume the furniture of home, lest we should see where we are, lost in a haunted wood, children afraid of the night, who've never been happy or good. All I have is a voice to undo the folded lie, the romantic lie in the brain of the sensual man in the street, and the lie of authority whose buildings grope the sky. We must love one another or die. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies, yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them of Eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame.
That was Marie Ponceau reading W.H. Auden's poem, September 1st, 1939. You're listening to Studio 360, and this is Kurt Anderson. With me today is the poet Marie Ponceau and the composer John Corigliano. And we are talking about the ways in which art and artists, if we're lucky, can help us cope and deal with this remarkable moment. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with the poet Marie Ponceau and the composer John Corigliano about the role of art and artists at this particular and terribly difficult moment. John Corigliano, your AIDS symphony embodies simultaneously a sense of grief and loss and mourning, but with a clear sense of rage over this loss.
It does, and actually, in a strange way, 20 years ago, many Americans were invaded, in fact, by an unknown enemy. We didn't even know what to search for. People died and other people lived in fear for the rest of their lives. This is not a parallel of course, in certain ways, because a jihad is man-organized and a virus is not. But as far as the reaction of the people involved in the cities of America that were devastated, so many of them live their lives right to this day with fear, just like living for fear of attack. Others died horrible deaths, just terrible deaths, lingering deaths. And so the symphony I wrote actually really was for my personal friends, one who was dying and many I have lost, and my colleagues. And so it had those elements in it. The first movement is called Of Rage and Remembrance. And for me, rage comes out of impotence. That is the reason rage happens, whether it's someone you love dying from AIDS or your parents with Alzheimer's or cancer, is you can't do anything about it. And one of the things about this particular tragedy that we all are very much aware of is how helpless we are. In my symphony, the very opening of it simply is a single note held by all the strings as they change from one position of that same note to another, so that the sound gets thicker and deeper and thicker and deeper, but never changes, and then starts to vibrate and then explodes. And this happens twice, and it's like a giant fist pushing through concrete until it comes out. That was my visual image of the oral description of what I did. And the first movement alternates that sense of rage with the remembrance of a friend who was dying and died a week after the premiere, who was a pianist. And so the tenderness that memory can bring is offset by the rage. And the symphony is like that, but at the very end of the symphony, it changes entirely. The next to the last movement is based upon a melody that I derived from improvisations with an amateur cellist friend of mine. All of the friends who died were lifelong friends. And it's my quilt. And in it, I remember many, many friends. And William Hoffman, who I mentioned earlier, who knew these people, wrote epitaphs for them. And then I set the epitaphs and removed the words so that they existed in music alone as an abstraction, because a symphony is an abstract work. On the other hand, it does relate definitely to people. And that quilt travels by and then builds into a funeral march of great passion. And finally, the very last image left for the audience of the symphony is that of foreverness. I tried to capture the sound of ocean waves in a circle of brass that encircle the orchestra, playing these very, very simple opening chords, just as waves continue forever. And the idea was to bring back the melodies of these friends in this sea of tranquility in which they live in our memory, and to know that through our memory and our remembrance of them, they stay alive.
That was Gian Corigliano's first symphony written about the epidemic of AIDS that we have suffered in this country for a long time, and the rage that one feels about it and in mourning for its victims. But of course, the rage and the anger that I think people do feel now about this attack and this hatred that's being directed towards America, towards New York, the rage one feels at a human being is very different than the rage one feels at God, at the accident of illness, at whatever. Is it not?
I don't want to sound too fancy, but I really think that all rage is the same.
Yeah, I think so too.
And I think the rage is not at a person or at an infection, but at injustice. If maybe that's too fancy, but I don't think so, because one of the first things kids learn long before they're supposed to be able to think abstractly or to have moral judgments, they will say, and they know it's an ethical question, that's not fair. We know the difference between fair and not fair, and this is not fair.
John, you wrote your AIDS Symphony sometime, considerable time after the plague had begun, did you not?
Yes, after I remember at a certain point I stopped counting in my address book after 100 people were no longer living, so it was some time.
And there was in the theater as well as in for poets in all kinds of arts, there was a sense that this was such a sort of totalizing fact, the AIDS, the death of AIDS and everything, that this must be dealt with in one's art. Is this current moment and whatever it leads to going to be that kind of historical, irresistible, unavoidable fact for poets and composers?
I think it enters perhaps a little slowly into poetry. It's not an instant possibility. But the emotions and their resolution in your work are so powerful that I hope for our sake, for those of us who rely on art to get us through tough spots, that it does turn out once again to be some sort of a form of healing. My students asked me that question last week. They said, this is too much to write about. They're graduate students at Barnard, at Columbia. And they said, this is too much. You can't write about this. There's nothing you can say. There's no language for it. But of course, there is eventually.
Yes, and I think the specificness of this may be addressed by certain people, but the abstract idea of this force destroying so much and of the terror of this can be created, certainly in music, which is such an abstract art. For example, the symphony that you heard a little bit of was specifically written for friends who died of AIDS, and I said one who was dying, but it wasn't titled an AIDS symphony. It was titled Symphony No. 1. And in the program note, I described why I wrote it. But it also could be listened to as a tragic symphony. And in fact, when it was played in Kiev some years ago in the Ukraine, which didn't have any AIDS at all and very little communication about it, and in which the program notes never got printed up because of the mess of the governmental forces at that time. And so all they had was the billboard with the four movements listed and Symphony No. 1. The audience reacted exactly the same way as they did 2 weeks later when I heard it in San Francisco, where everyone was hearing it as an AIDS piece, because in a sense we draw out from the specific into the human and bigger issues of life and death and love and all of this. And that's where art excels, really. And that's why I think, yes, pieces will be written about it, but we may not know that.
Well, and interestingly, I read Marie your poem "We All Die Young" within the last few days, which suddenly struck me as a poem about this moment, and of course, it was not.
I think it's always a possible human moment. Suffering is one of the things we are pretty experienced with.
Well, and of course, as we watch these television images and read the newspaper accounts of all of these young people talking to their loved ones and their wives and husbands and parents as they were about to die, that to me is the most overwhelming part of the nonfiction, the journalistic accounts of this thing.
It really is incredible. There's never been anything remotely resembling that before. And someone said that it was the mad terrorists who were encouraging them to do it. I wonder if they had any sense of
how far
that would carry.
And if that's true, a vision, a glimpse of a kind of evil that's almost unimaginable to me.
I think so.
Can you read your poem?
It's called Oceans. Death is breathtaking. We all die young. Our lives defined by failure of the heart, our fire drowned in failure of the lungs. Still, planning on pouring the best ripe part of wines our need or grasp has sucked or wrung from fruit and sun. We're stopped before we start. Taste, like talk, fades from the stiffening tongue. In reach of what we've wanted, our hope is strung toward closing cords of accomplishment. We grip ourselves. Cut off, we go, stunned, raw as a land child brought out to see only ocean all the way to sky. Shut in awe, we wrap our secret in us as we die unsaid, the deaf objects of goodbye. It's an eternal mystery, I guess, to realize how much dies with each person, what a richness of knowledge and experience and feeling and hope and plans and ordinary desire to have a good breakfast.
Actually, Knoxville, summer of 1915, which is one of my favorite, if not my favorite, pieces of Samuel Barber's James Aggie text, is about America and sitting on your porch and watching your neighbors go by and coiling the hose and listening to the streetcars go by. And the reason I love it so much is it's so simple. In a way, and I guess maybe I'm wrong in this, but I always feel that our greatest attribute is our simplicity and directness, and that that this poem comes out of simple talk, so beautifully phrased, about simple people, that it's just terribly moving. And Samuel Barber gave it a setting of such eloquence and beauty that it is a miniature masterpiece.
Giancarlano. That was Samuel Barber's Knoxville, summer of 1915. And is one of the reasons you like that as a requiem piece is because, in fact, it isn't lugubriously sad. It sounds like, to my relatively untrained ear, a celebration of the simple humanity of America.
Because of exactly that. It celebrates the simplicity of what we are in the most beautiful way. And I think we have to remember that. And we have to keep that. I mean, with all that happened around us, we have to keep that wonderful spirit and beauty that we can have.
You're listening to Studio 360. This is Kurt Anderson, and I'm talking today with the poet Marie Ponceau and the composer Giancarlano about the ways in which art and artists can help us deal with this extraordinary moment. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with the poet Marie Ponceau and the composer Giancarlano about the role of art and artists at this terribly difficult moment. John and Marie, how do we understand this, or should we understand what happened to New York a week or two ago as an attack on New York? It strikes me, and maybe this is a wrong reaction, but it struck me, and it strikes me that all of the reasons I moved to New York from Omaha, Nebraska, it's license, its swagger, its freedom, its eccentricity, its, you know, everything about that I loved about New York and still love is what seems to enrage those people who attacked us.
We can't divide it up and say, well, this is what they hate us for. We don't know that they hate us. We know that they hurt us. We know that they hurt us desperately. We know that they worked very hard, lived with that hate in their hearts, planning it out step by step for a long time, put themselves to enormous trouble, and gave their lives. But we don't really know what they were thinking, and we certainly can't single out attributes of our own being that provoked them unless we go back to something very broad and very general and say that violence begets violence. And those who think that evil has been done to them will do evil back again to perpetuate that cycle.
Marie, you were alive during World War II and writing poetry during World War II. I was struck, another poem of yours I was struck by reading the last few days was your poem, Two Questions. I wonder if you could read that for us.
Yes, I remember World War II very, very well. The boys who fought in World War II were the boys I went to proms with, you know.
Did you have any ambivalence about that, or was it the good war and the just war as I grew up being told?
It was a great suffering for me. I believed at the time that war was not going to solve anything. But I could see that something had to happen. I was 18, and it was real suffering inside my head, because it was not something you could really talk about to very many people. It was at that point I discovered an organization called the Catholic Worker, which was a pacifist organization, very tiny, of course, but very persistent, still there, that, like the Quakers, thought that there had to be another solution. But I didn't think there was another solution, not in my heart. I could see that there was no way out. And I could see my friends, many of whom had married quickly and who spent their days and their nights with a radio at their ear, trying to find out what was happening, where the person they cared most about in the world had gone. It was a very intense time, and that's what I tried to raise in Two Questions. Something that is perhaps unfairly privileged in being written once the horrors that World War II was inspired by were out of the way. This is called Two Questions, and it's for Larry Ferlinghetti, Jean Fontanelle, Greg Malley and Dominic Yetzo, all men of goodwill and sometime armed forces. These were the boys I knew, right? Some of them survived. Some didn't. This is about one of those dropped, brilliant, in such windrush he can't scream. He's moving too fast in the pitch black, falling, his parachute, hot buckles and charred string. He is on fire. He hits salt water. Goes out as he goes under. It chokes with him in his throat, that shout. Fire, the flare human, the body of burning plunging, shot star, sea quenched. 50 years on fire in my mind. Second hand. Dreamed a silence of scream, heat into cold, extinguishing. Waked by, wept for, guessed at, an ignorant dream, dreaming those who flew to kill, again toward gunfire, flew, killed. But he burned, that boy, my age, Lieutenant Little, prayed for in my parish, monthly, 30 years till his mother died. Who else would remember? His lovers at then 21 have long loved others, only those who made him up, out of anguish, ignorant among war news, remember what the order of murder made. Our catch basin cities swirl with blood until some larder stocked. We stop, come home, wash up, and restore peace as if there were no war. If slaughter always alters our memory, if brutal mistakes are fatal so far, and if I, no Amazon, agree no life is free of brute fatality, what is a safe childhood for? Of what is war the history? I meant those to be real questions to which I do not know the answer. I'm not sure I know who knows the answer or if there is any answer.
The lack of simple response and simple answers, I think, is one of the important things to, frankly, embrace as inevitable in this instance. Assuming war proceeds, how will artists deal with a situation in which the appropriate response is not black or white? Or is that what art is all about, is to sort of deal with situations of gray and confusion and complexity?
Probably. I think whenever people in whatever kind of community we have begin to think about a problem together, what they come up with is new questions that don't have answers. They're what the French call un vrai problème. There, it's a real question. A real question is one to which you don't know the answer before you ask it, in a way. And it is the work of art to try to find, to try to find some of those answers, emotionally, intellectually, schematically, structurally, the way music does. That's the hope, anyway, and it's our excuse. I always like to remember something that a critic named Northrop Frye writes about. He says, when you begin to question what is art good for, you have to remember that among peoples who own materially almost nothing, a little blubber and a little ice, the peoples of the far north have almost nothing, but they have art. They have poems. They have music. They have visual art.
Well, which leads, I think, to what I want to talk about as well, which is the role of art of all kinds as a source of comfort and a sense of providing some glimmer of a sense of renewal and getting on to the next thing. Are there songs? Are there poems that that at this moment you would send people to go to other than the ones we've read and we've heard already for consolation, for healing sense?
Oh, there are streams of them. The kind of despair that we're very tempted to feel now is not new. The occasion for it is more dreadful than most, but the one that I say to myself walking down the street when I need to is Shakespeare. Fear no more the heat of the sun, nor the winter's furious rages. Thou thy earthly task hath done. Home art gone and taken thy wages. Golden lads and girls all must, like chimney sweepers, come to dust. There are two more stanzas, but I cannot say them out loud without crying.
And there will be those, I'm sure, in the coming weeks and months who return to Henry V and his "We happy few, we band of brothers" as we...
I fear so.
...we proceed. John Corigliano, you've mentioned Marianne Williams.
Right. Well, I think that I just fell in love with Marianne Williams once many years ago. There was a show playing in New York called The Black Nativity. Langston Hughes had written it. And it was a night before closing night, and I went to see it. And there was this force of nature and this fabulous show. And I had heard gospel on recordings, but it's quite a different thing to experience it live and also when projected by a person of what I think is phenomenal, artistic, and just the bigger than life human being. I mean, Falstaff singing gospel, just that's how it felt. She's just amazing.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson talking today with the composer John Corigliano and the poet Marie Ponceau about art and the ways in which music and poetry and film and novels can help to begin to make some sense of what we're facing in light of the attack on New York and Washington on the 11th of September. the day or two, maybe 2 days after the attack when I was back home, and somehow where I was grocery shopping, I heard Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man come over, the Muzak, in a supermarket of all things. And I thought, man, this suddenly that music was another piece of music that seemed incredibly and serendipitously appropriate to this moment.
And, you know, I also heard is I think CNN or one of those networks, when they have the flag and the logo, they play part of Our Town of Copland, a very innocent, again, like the barber, kind of Copland, not the dramatic military one, but the dee-da-dee-da-da. And it's extremely beautiful music and kind of and quintessentially American. And I kind of think that's wonderful, too.
Well, and as we've seen and have been, again, moved to tears of various kinds by the images of heroism and the stories of heroism and reaching out to strangers and to loved ones. Again, in, you know, the Fanfare for the Common Man in that very literal sense begins to seem like something that couldn't be more appropriate.
And don't forget that was all written around the time of the Second World War, and we're talking about a belief in America that Copland had, and the kind of Americana that came out of that has been gone for many years. I mean, we you know, that kind of optimism. In fact, one of the reasons I think Aaron stopped composing really towards the end of his life is because he needed that, and he was disillusioned about America a bit, and it stopped him really, I think, from continuing to write the music that he wanted to write.
I want to thank you both, John Corigliano and Marie Ponceau, for being with us today and reading some poems and playing some music. As we make our way through as best we can this bizarre, extraordinary, remarkable time. And as we go out, as we leave Studio 360 today, let's listen to Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Thank you.
Studio 360 is co-produced by WNYC Radio and Public Radio International and is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, the David B. Gold Foundation, and the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, supporting education, the arts, and culture to enrich community life. Additional funding comes from this and other PRI stations nationwide.
Our special thanks this week go to MJI Broadcasting, Sirius Satellite Radio, Minnesota Public Radio, and Larry Josephson.
PRI, Public Radio International.